Bonjour à toutes et à tous et bienvenue dans Fleurs d'avocat. Je suis Lila-Louise Maréchaux et dans ce podcast, je vais à la rencontre des avocats bien dans leur robe. Hi everyone and welcome on Fleurs d'avocat. I am Lila-Louise Maréchaux and in this podcast, I share with you my conversations with lawyers who are happy to be lawyers. L'épisode d'aujourd'hui est un peu spécial car mon invité est néerlandais et nous avons échangé en anglais. Je n'ai pas prévu de traduire cet épisode, donc s'il y a des auditeurs non anglophones parmi vous, j'espère que vous ne m'en voudrez pas. Fleurs d'avocat, so far, has only been a French podcast and I have only interviewed French lawyers in French. But as I visited a friend in Amsterdam, I thought it could be nice and interesting to seize the opportunity to interview a lawyer there and broaden a little our vision. I didn't personally know any lawyer in Amsterdam, so I asked Jan Ortjes, sorry Jan for scratching your name, who is a Dutch lawyer who was working at Clifford Chance in Paris while I was an intern there. And luckily he had a few happy Dutch lawyers in mind, and he put me in contact with one of them who accepted this invitation. So thank you, Jan, for putting me in contact with today's interviewee. So I am happy to introduce you to Jelle Klaas. Jelle is a lawyer since 2004. He is specialized in human rights litigation. After almost 15 years in the law firm, he joined as an in-house attorney the Dutch section of the International Commission of Jurists, which is a non-profit organization, and as such, he leads the Public Interest Litigation Project. The Public Interest Litigation Project, the PILP, is a project that explores the possibility of using strategic litigation in the field of human rights in the Netherlands. Jelle explains what is strategic litigation and how it is different from normal litigation in the episode, so I won't explain any further in this introduction. However, I would like to say that I am very happy to bring you this point of view on the profession from abroad because in France, it is not possible to work in-house and to litigate at the same time. Litigation being only possible when one is a lawyer in a law firm. So I feel like it's an interesting point of view and something that we don't have in France, and as such, that it adds value to the podcast. As always, please, 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 if you haven't done it already, take a few minutes to leave a comment and stars on iTunes or the app that you use. It really makes a difference, and it helps me reach new listeners who might be inspired by Fleurs d'Avocat, just as you are. Thank you for listening and enjoy this conversation. Hello, Jelle Klaas.
Hello.
Thank you for being my guest on Fleurs d'Avocat.
I'm honored.
So, Jelle, please explain me how and why you became a lawyer.
Well, I have a few things that I am good at, and I have a lot of things I am not good at. Everything with math is very difficult for me, so a lot of jobs were unavailable for me, and I wanted to do something to also be able to contribute to society, and I liked rules, so I started studying law with the idea that I could maybe become a public attorney or something, and during my studies I became very politically active against the war and anti-globalism and stuff like that. And then I couldn't become a public attorney anymore because I had too strong political opinions.
How did you realize this, that you couldn't become a public attorney anymore?
Well, not because I would have been rejected, but because of my political beliefs. It would be too difficult to do a job where I would defend the status quo, because I had so much problems with the status quo. And okay. I still have a lot of problems with the status quo.
And you had identified public attorney as being a job where you actually defend the status quo.
Yeah, that's your job. I mean, if you if the government thinks that you should be fined for being Muslim or for being poor or for sleeping in a place where you're not allowed to sleep because you don't have a place to go, then the public attorney will have to prosecute based on those laws. Mm-hmm. You have no, and you have to morally defend these laws. And if you are very opposed to these laws, or you want to only help people and causes that you think are just, it's much easier to be a lawyer. So I went into politically active demonstrations across the world and conferences, and then I didn't know what to do, and then I bumped into a lawyer that was politically active, and he did social law, so only helping poor people, and That was amazing, and I could work for him.
How did you bump into him?
So he was also active in this movement.
Okay.
Yeah, and a bit older than I was, and was very experienced both in political movements, but especially in law, and he had his own law firm.
Did you do an internship?
Yeah.
In his law firm?
Yeah.
How did it go?
Yeah, I thought it was amazing. So I studied in Groningen, which is in the north of the Netherlands, and his firm was and is in Haarlem, which is, well, the Netherlands is a very small country, but it's quite far. For Dutch, it's 2.5 hours or something, 2 hours with the train. But I'd love to do that because it was...
So you did all the way from Amsterdam to the law firm?
Yeah, I lived in Groningen and I went to Haarlem, which is near Amsterdam. Yeah, so I traveled there and I slept over with friends in Amsterdam. But I thought it was so amazing to actually meet these people and be able to really try to help them with a skill that you can offer that's something that, well, they don't have because it's all extremely complicated, and that you can actually help them get food or shelter or housing. And it was very, I really thought it was an amazing job.
So you had you could see your direct impact.
Yeah, exactly. And I could also meet a lot of people and really stand next to them in their struggle and in their hardships. I mean, you don't share their hardships, but I visited a lot of people at their homes and I saw how the situation was, and I really, it was very good also for my societal views to really see what poverty is about and what these people face and why they get in situations like these. Also because the laws are so complicated and made in a way that it's very difficult for people to get out of this situation. And then to be able to help them and, well, lose a lot of the times, but sometimes even win. That was very satisfying.
So after this internship, what happened?
Yeah, so I really wanted to stay there. So I moved to Amsterdam in 2004, 2005, and I became a lawyer.
So how do you become a lawyer in the Netherlands?
Yeah, so you have to have studied Dutch law, a certain part of Dutch law. And I was in the old system, and now the new system with bachelor master system, but we had the old, we have the French system largely.
Okay.
But there are a few differences, but it looks a lot like the French system. And
there's like a first examination to enter in a school? And then you have some mandatory internships, something like this?
No mandatory internships, not for law. But you, in my time, you had to do a general Dutch law, and then you could specialize in, and I did criminal law, but you can do, well, a lot of administrative law or international law. But you had to have this Dutch law perspective to get civil effect, to be able to go to court. And now with the bachelor master structure, that's also like that. A lot of these are specifically also aimed at getting civil effect. So it was...
So civil effect is the title of a lawyer?
No, civil effect is that the study allows you to go to court at certain when you are entered as a lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you study policy and international law or something like that, and you don't get any Dutch law, then you cannot get civil effect. That study does not give you a ticket to be able to become a lawyer and to actually practice.
Okay.
So you will be called a lawyer, like the Americans call everyone who studied law a lawyer. But
you won't you're be not like an advocate. Attorney.
Yeah, yes. you're not an advocate or an attorney, exactly.
Okay.
So to become an attorney, to actually be able to go to court, you have to do a specific type of law. Most law studies have that. And it's 4 years.
And so you mentioned you specialized in criminal law.
Yeah.
Within that frame.
Yeah. So I first did the
master's
general
in criminal, yeah.
general Dutch law, and then I had to choose something, and well, criminal law is the most spicy part and
okay.
most interesting, I think. So I did that, and then you have to find a lawyer that will be your patroon, who will be it's sort of an internship, but it is a bit the old guild. System. So you have to find...
Like your mentor.
Yeah, exactly. And they will be responsible for you for 3 years. So you have to be enrolled in the... there are several districts, lawyers' districts of the Dutch bar.
Yeah.
And it's a very medieval system. So we also have the old terms. A deacon is the head of the system of every district.
And how did you choose, pick your mentor? Or how did he choose you?
Yeah, so I chose to become a lawyer because of him.
Okay.
And after the internship went very well, the study internship, so I started working as a student, and we really had a click. I knew I still had to work on a lot of things, but we had the same political opinions, and I really wanted to become a lawyer for his firm, and he wanted to learn someone, have an apprentice.
Okay.
So it's an apprenticeship.
That same lawyer that you bumped into. So you went back to his law
firm. I stayed with him, and then I got enrolled as a... it's called an advocaat stagiaire, so it's a lawyer apprentice. And then you are a lawyer by law, so you can go to court and you can do everything. But if you really screw it up, then
it's your boss's
liability.
And so what about these apprentice years?
Yeah, so it's 3 years, and one of these years you have to do the lawyer's education thing. And that's quite intense, also because you're already working for a law firm. And I thought that was also very interesting to meet all these other lawyers. And some of them had a very different perspective and very different practice, especially the ones working for the very big law firms, talking about big numbers, a lot of money, whilst we were doing a lot of court cases almost every week for people, much more, you could say practical, or much more human contact, very different. And I thought that was interesting. And after these 3 years... one of these years you have to do these exams also and learn for them, and you have to get all the law, what you learn at university, but then in a bit more practical way, what applies for lawyers and our own lawyers guild rules. And then when you succeed, and after 3 years the guild, the local guild, says, well, you can become a lawyer, then you are inscribed on the roll.
Yes.
So it's, you're put on there.
But I mean, you said you joined, so you stayed in that law firm with the lawyer that you had met, and you really liked how he actually worked. And how did it go as, more advanced as you were staying there that time as a lawyer?
Yeah, this lawyer, Pim Fischer, is a brilliant strategist. He's a very, very interesting, very, very intelligent lawyer who really, really knows how to fight for his clients and is very dedicated, but also sometimes a bit difficult to work with. I really had to learn how to work with him because he's very, in his head. But when I learned how to do that in these 3 years, and we did a lot of social law, so people on benefits, that their benefits were taken from them, and we fought for that. And we shifted more and more over the years to helping people that were also, because the laws were changing, we were seeing more neoliberal policies. Then the Netherlands was a welfare state, but during the years, because of new neoliberal policies, it was more and more possible to take away all the income of people because they didn't do well or they were undocumented. So we got our first cases in 2005-06, where people were really hungry and really lacking food. So our practice changed, and we became more social, economic, human rights lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Before we follow up on this, you said that you had to learn how he functioned, how he worked. How did you do that? Do you remember some, days that you kind of understood something, or...
I know that at a certain point, because I wrote these appeals, like in administrative cases, and then I put them in this post book, and then he checked the post book with a red pen or a blue pen or whatever. And I know at one point I wrote something that I thought was great, and I got rejected 3 or 4 times over. And I was at a certain point realized it's better to just swallow and think, okay, I think he's more experienced, and I'm just going to do what he says. and then we'll see. And if then I find out maybe my route was better, then that's the basis I will discuss. So not be too arrogant also sometimes just look at that he was, because he always has a longer term thinking. So that was one of the moments I also really thought, I'm not going to debate everything. I'm just going to first do it, listen, do it, work hard, amend it again. And then finally it's okay. And then we'll send and we'll see. And then most of the times he was right. The things he was pointing me at. So that was very, yeah, I learned a lot from that.
And did you, so you said most of the time he was right. At what point maybe would you be able more to argue on your roots?
Yeah, when it's about, when I became more experienced and I'm a very different person. So he also valued our differences very much, and he still does that. Even though I'm now working for the firm anymore, but he knows that he is better at certain longer strategic legal points, and I am better, I think, in social strategic issues, mm-hmm. and also knowing how to frame something, and we got to really complement each other more. And I had to fight for that sometimes, but I also think that he saw when sometimes I was right.
Yeah. And so you said that the practice changed because of the new laws, and so you went more into social economical. Did you like the fact that you were kind of at the beginning of a new practice?
Yeah, certainly. That was also very frustrating because we really feel for these people. And that's also one of the if you want to do work like that, you're not doing it to become rich. That's also something that we really wanted to do. And if you see these people suffering, that's very harsh. And sometimes then it's very frustrating that because the law changed, the municipality in cutting their allowances was right from a legal perspective. But because, maybe because we're in it from a more political perspective, we were thinking, yeah, but morally speaking, from a civilization perspective, this is not right. This is wrong to have people who are hungry denied food. So that was the main reason that we, and especially my mentor, started looking for different legal routes to at least win, because we want to win for these people. And then we just tried a lot of stuff, and at a certain point we had a case that was so harsh, and it was with children who had no food and no water, and everyone in the court was crying because it was so obvious that this was just wrong. And my colleague just tried the child's right treaty. And this was the first judge that said, yeah, I see your point, and we're going for the child's right treaty. And
so the child's right treaty is, it's an international law treaty? Okay.
Yeah. The UN child's right treaty that is, all countries in the world except the United States have signed it.
Okay.
And it's very difficult in the Netherlands with the direct effect of certain international treaties. Some of them have a direct, because we don't have a constitutional court, so we cannot use the constitution in court.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's about fundamental rights, we can only use international law. And the European Convention is completely has direct effect, but everything outside of that is difficult. And
so that was a light.
So that was a light, and we won that case, and the law changed, and that tasted like, we want to do that more. And at that moment, I was also still doing a lot of criminal law. I was helping youth criminal law. That was part of my job.
As a pro bono or as part of your job?
No, it's all on legal aid. Yeah, okay. So I was doing that as a lawyer. So the main practice of the law firm was social, economic, human rights and social law. And also a lot of lawyers then, and it's, I think still at these firms also do, they're on a list of lawyers and when people get arrested.
Okay. We have the same, yeah.
Yeah, and I was on a special list for youth, so I did a lot of youth cases for a lot of years. And there we also bumped into problems and changes in the law and children that were put in prison where they did not belong. And then we also tried from a perspective of this is just wrong, it shouldn't be like this. We went to the civil court, and that was also a very interesting experience because a lot of media attention was for that. 12-year-old kid suing the state because he's in prison had a nice ring to it. So we learned a lot there also on more political cases. And the combination eventually led us to become a firm that only did social economic human rights.
And so that was within just the 3 years, or did you stay there more?
I stayed there until last year.
Oh, okay. So yeah. That's very recent. Yeah. So you've done all your experience, all your training, you've done it in this law firm.
Yeah. And in 2008, I started doing different cases apart from the socioeconomic. I did a few cases on anti-discrimination and racism, also because I've still kept my ties with activist movements and circles.
So those clients, they came from those activist circles?
The majority of the clients from our firm were just poor people who came in, or people from NGOs and homeless shelters that they sent to us, because the majority of the case was on food, shelter, clothing, education, all these basic social economic rights that was and still is the expertise of the firm. I, at a certain point, also dropped my youth criminal clients and also focused on cases like that. And we had a few extra lawyers, also female fantastic lawyers that joined the firm. So at a certain point, we were with about, I think we were with 11 or 12 personnel.
So it went growing.
Yeah, yeah, it was very, we were really making an impact. So part of
How
them,
did that
our
feel?
Lawyers, yeah, fantastic. Also because you're part of, well, really combating laws and a policy that you think is wrong. And we had a firm with a few very good lawyers, very dedicated, and a staff that were supporting us and that were... So, for instance, we were always open for people that are homeless. And people that are really homeless, you cannot make an appointment for in 3 weeks at 3 o'clock. They should, when they're in problems, they should always be able to walk into your office. And that requires you to have a certain staff that's always willing to make a small talk with them and ask them how they are and help them with smaller
so
issues.
So how did you recruit?
Well, on the basis of that, so really looking for people that were intrinsically interested in not helping people from a, I think you're very, from a savior complex, from I'm going to help you because I'm better in your pathetic, and from that perspective I'm going to help you, but from a more a social ally, this could also happen to me, I just have a privileged position and I've studied law and I really want to be your ally and really help you to get out of problems like that. So people that had that perspective and also political perspective of the law is wrong, the people are not.
So there was like a real culture in the firm of this. It was really like...
Yeah, and very, very hard work, always working for the clients.
And how did you manage to still... Did you manage to keep a distance with how harsh it was for the clients?
Yes, because sometimes it's difficult. I think it's also what your character is. I think for some people it's much more difficult than for others. But I think for me and most of my colleagues, we could do this because we bring them our expertise, and our expertise is limited to legal help, so not with social help. And if it's social help, well, we couldn't offer it to them, and then it also stops. So with legal stuff, we would go to, well, every length to try to get them their rights. And then it means you have to work very hard, etc. But the courts are only open from 9 to 5. So that means that in the nights or in the weekends, most of the time we didn't need to work. Or they couldn't also call me on my mobile phone or whatever. We were always open every day, but not in the evening. So I could, I think that, and being very professional also really helped. So having a professional distance to these clients, so at the same time standing next to them, but as their lawyer. So wearing a suit really helps, looking like a lawyer, which is difficult if you have long hair and earrings and stuff, but still wearing a suit is helpful. And well, we tried a lot of these things to have enough distance, but at the same time be close enough.
So you stayed many years in this law firm and it really developed well. How come you chose to leave? What happened?
there are a lot of reasons, but the main two reasons is I started doing a few other cases. Since 2008, I did a few cases from our law firm that were even more political, and also for a group of activists. Or activists was a case about people from Iranian descent that are from Iran or were born in the Netherlands, but their parents are from Iran. And because of a law, they were not allowed entry into university at 8 master courses and in 5 institutes because of proliferation, because of nuclear atomic bomb scare. The government said, we don't trust people that are from Iran. So my client was, one of the clients was a professor of nuclear physics who taught students on nuclear physics. He couldn't enter his own building. He had to teach in the canteen. So that was a brilliant case, but very complicated. And we really built that case together with academics, activists, lobby. There were a lot of aspects and was a very big case up until the Supreme Court. And I had the feeling I could really combine both my political ideas and campaigning and social skills with my lawyer skills. So I think it's fantastic if you do a day-to-day working with individuals and help them out of their nasty situation. But it is very difficult to actually change the laws or empower a community. But if you build more strategic cases that are meant to empower communities or to destroy a certain law, that's also very interesting.
So
that's the main...
This strategy, you said that your mentor was a very good strategist. Did you really learn from him this perspective? And how did you... So this case, it came to you. Did you from the beginning say, okay, so if we want to have a chance on this, we need to build it in a different way. We can't just go legal, and we have to go with other partners that are not from the legal side. How did it come up?
So my colleague is fantastic in thinking on strategy, on expertises that we had in-house, so on social laws, on benefit. But this was a case that required an expertise that we just did not have. And I think a lot of lawyers have a bit of a macho perspective and are afraid to collaborate with others. But I just knew I did not have this expertise and will never have this expertise. I'm a very bad academic and I'm not brilliant in writing legal arguments. I can do it, but there are people that are better. So to be able to, but I really wanted to do this case, and I knew I had the skills on the human rights arguments and the anti-racist arguments in that case and in building a coalition. So I just called academics and asked them, do you want to help me? Because I don't know how to do this. And that felt, you first have to do that once, but then you can see that the case will just become better. And you also work with other lawyers that have their expertises. So that was the first time we really did that case, and we did that with my current NGO also, mm-hmm. with the Dutch Section for the International Commission of Jurists. So that was, new, and it really worked well because we won the case, and we've done it in a way that I think I would have never done it alone because of, like I said. And the second reason I went away with the firm was also because of the legal cutbacks, because it's more and more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Because I was about to ask you about your business plan. So all of this is paid by the state, mm-hmm. by subsidies for legal aid? Yeah.
Yeah, so in 2008 or 2009, we helped hundreds of people. And if you are very specialized, then you don't need to take up the law every time, and but you can give your clients a lot of attention on the individual issues and on the facts. But because you know the law and you're part of making the jurisprudence, you can save time there. And if you can ask legal aid for every case and go to court a lot, we had a fine model. I mean, we weren't becoming rich, but we could just... afford
work, yeah.
We could just work perfectly, and it was a very good system. But because of a lot of legal aid cutbacks, and it's only becoming worse and worse in the Netherlands, it became very, very difficult. And we lost hundreds, but we won a few very important cases for undocumented migrants. the right to food, shelter, and clothing. And the government said, we don't want this. And they wanted to close our firm because, well, we were winning and they didn't want undocumented people to get money.
How did that go?
There was a lot of media attention and questions in parliament that were prepared, and that made them withdraw their plans to try to shut us down. But it was very difficult because we didn't get paid for a few months. And that was very difficult. All our money came from the state.
Yeah, of course.
And it felt, it well, showed how vulnerable we were. And
you were at the very at the heart of... It's not only that then you fight as a lawyer for a client that is not advantaged in society, it's that then the lawyer itself is a target. So you're really at the heart of something very sensitive.
Yeah, yeah. And that was also very... very difficult to also, I mean, so there's the general cutbacks of legal aid and austerity measures, but there was also this specific target on our cases because we were only helping people without money. So to give an example, if you get legal aid for a case, the lawyer gets paid a few hundred euros per case, but a part of the case has to be paid by the client itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's deducted from the amount that you get. But if someone is undocumented or comes to our office because they have no food, we will not first ask them. We have to ask them to pay that money, but we don't. We couldn't. And because that amount of money that they have to pay themselves became bigger and bigger, and they were also saying that they would sue lawyers that were not asking that amount mm-hmm. from their clients. There was a lot of pressure there. It was very difficult. And with the main case that we won at the European Committee for Social Rights on the right to food, shelter and clothing, the government almost fell. There was a crisis in the government because of that case. So they weren't in love with our law firm at that moment.
And how did the activists feel about all this?
Yeah, so I think this specific group of activists that we worked with were the We Are Here group, so a group of self-organized grassroots undocumented, and their allies. And, I mean, they were the real heroes of this whole tale. I mean, they thought about the strategies. They made the cases public. They were in the news, even though they could be arrested and deported. Well, most of the times they couldn't be deported, but arrested again and arrested again. So we were their lawyers. So they felt they weren't happy that their lawyers were also under fire, even though I don't know if all of them really realized what was happening to us. But their helpers, especially the churches and the anarchist groups that were really helping, are still helping the undocumented, were very angry with it. But yeah, it's not the most sexy topic and the most sexy group, helping people without a permit to stay.
No, and at the same time, I believe that because that's how you came to being an attorney, right? Because you wanted to go against what you felt was not right from a political point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, I guess it must have been very difficult to go through this phase where your law firm is targeted by the government and you don't have money coming in and stuff. And at the same time, well, you're at the heart of what you wanted to do. So some kind of flow must have been going on at that moment.
Yeah, and like I said, I mean, we lost 95% of all cases. And these are cases that we really, really believe in. So it's people that are not being deported, that are still in a procedure over their permit to stay and are not allowed to get, and they have the right to medicine. So one of my clients had HIV, AIDS, had kidney failures, depression. So I had this huge cocktail of medicine that he had to take every day, and he got it from his doctors, but he had no right to get a bread or water. So he couldn't take the medicine after his meal. And that's so absurd. And then if you go to court and you have all these strong human rights that say if people are hungry, you should feed them, and that's the fundamental right, and you don't get it, it's also very frustrating and very, very difficult also because you don't want to give your clients hope But by going to court, you do give them some hope. And then if you fail, it's very, very horrible. It's, two of our clients died in that period also because of the situation. And it's a lot of them were in really, really horrible, inhumane circumstances, according to the Dutch Institute for Human Rights. So then it's also very frustrating.
So to go back to the fact that you chose to, I mean, you separated from this law firm. So there was that money cut back that had an impact on the firm's way of working. And also, I understand that it's also because you developed a new expertise and like a new case base. Did it need to, never needs to, but yeah, was it like obvious that you needed to separate from the law firm you were in to keep on with this work?
I could have stayed at the law firm, but it was getting more and more difficult. But it's exactly like you said. I mean, there was, I had developed a new way of working that I also really liked. And then I was already an active member of the Dutch section for the International Commission of Jurists, the NUCM, who helped me in this Iranian case. And I was active in one of their working groups. And for a lot of reasons, the Netherlands was a country where it was very easy to talk with government officials and to talk about human rights for a long time. I mean, I'm not saying it was perfect. I mean, if you're black or female or refugee, you could still face a lot of human rights problems. But comparatively, it was quite okay in the Netherlands. But because also because of neoliberalism and because of different political changes, it became more and more difficult to talk about human rights with the government. So a lot of NGOs and activists and lawyers, but especially NGOs, had the idea our tools, our toolkit isn't working anymore. So at that moment, an international organization and a few NGOs asked the Dutch section for the ICJ, why don't you start strategic litigation? Because it's something we see in the Anglo-Saxon world. It's a great tool to use to fight for your cause. It's something we don't know in the Netherlands. Don't you want to experiment? Don't you want to see if it works? And I thought it was fantastic to experiment with that. I thought this was, such an inspiring idea. And then all of a sudden I thought, I want to do that. This is what I want to try.
A new way of litigation.
Yeah, and to build these coalitions and to really think politically about litigation. And
so you really thrived in that teamwork.
Yeah, I think that's gets us much further if it's about a cause that also is in the public interest.
Yeah, and I say that because we were talking about a friend the other day, and it's true that lawyers, even if you work with a team with your client, you never really work as a team. You know, most of the time you work well with the partner you work with. Maybe you have one colleague or so, and then, you have your client and you have to like be partner with your client, but it's not like you work in a team. And so I guess that what you created for that case is that team thing.
Yeah, so I mean, we created this together. This was also something, I mean, we have a lot of volunteers and staff and especially also with our members. But when we started with the PILP, so my project, the Public Interest Litigation Project, my idea was also to first see how can we build these cases with lawyers working together in co-counsel. And we did a few of these cases and we had good and bad experiences. But at this moment, all our cases are in co-counsel. And one of the best examples, I think, is a very big case we're doing against the state on Afghan refugees. And there are four lawyers, two from one of the biggest corporate law firms in the Netherlands, who do the civil and the EU part of the case. Then there's one very famous human rights lawyer who does the refugee and migrant part. And it's also her client that is part of the case. And I do the human rights and the admissibility part from the NGO. So we had these four completely different lawyers from different NGO, human rights practice, and corporate practice together in court. And that's just, it's cool. It's just we only, because we're all in it for the cause, we don't get more money for it. It's just we really believe that this is a very important case to do. And we acknowledge that everyone has his or her own expertise. And it's just very cool to share and to, it only gets better as long as you have very strict conditions on who has the coordination, who is on what part of it. So I'm very enthusiastic about this model.
And so you said that you started the project of international litigation, the PIPL?
Public Interest Litigation Project.
Yeah, exactly. So there was that idea of litigating through the NGOs. How did you transform it into the project?
Well, first we needed to tell NGOs what strategic litigation is and that it's why it could be useful for them. So in the first year, when we started in 2014, I just drank a lot of coffee with a lot of people from all these different NGOs to try to... And my main question was, where do you think does it hurt? Where is a pain where lobby, campaigning, media isn't enough? And litigation might be an option. Because I also tried to explain to them how litigation can get you more facts, how it can get media attention, how sometimes you will get the opposing party in a forum where they have to answer. I mean, if you want to make a very good argument against the state and you have this brilliant lobby report, the state doesn't have to answer to that, and they will most of the times not do that. But if you sue them, they will have to give an answer. That can be a sole very good reason to do strategic litigation. And we thought that it would be complex, but also because, like I already said, it was getting more and more difficult for the bigger NGOs to lobby. A lot of them wanted to try and work with us, and we started a lot of cases and were quite successful. I mean, we're very busy at the moment.
So it was first explaining, and then it was, okay, now that I understand what it's about, we can try.
Yeah, and then they said, okay, look, we think this particular topic hurts, and our other tools aren't sufficient. So we did a case on, on the Afghan refugees, where all the other tools have been used. They knew this is wrong, the judges know it's wrong, the politicians know it's wrong, but we just need to build this specific civil case to maybe get to the Court of Justice in Luxembourg. And then we try to build a case like that. So we have law clinics and academia who do all the research, and sometimes it takes up to a year to see what's the jurisprudence in other countries, what are all the human rights norms we could invoke. Then we do a research on who could all the parties be that are involved, who are the communities that we want to do it with them and not for them. So we need to talk to everyone. Who are the right leaders? Do they really think this is the case to fight for, and is this something that they... So then we build these coalitions, also we find the right lawyers, and then at a certain point we start writing. And if the situation is still problematic, we ask mostly the government, but sometimes companies, please change it or else we'll see you in court. So that's how it's been going for the last years.
And how do you, who pays you?
Foundations. Yeah, so rich people's money.
Yeah.
Yeah, put in foundations. And we get core funding so that we don't have to, if you would get project funding, it would be more liable for only going for the low-hanging fruits. And now we can decide, our boundaries are human rights in the Netherlands, and it has to be in the public interest. So if it has these aspects, and we think strategic litigation could really help make it stronger, not because it could also really harm your campaign and then you don't want to do litigation, then we can do it. We can just do all cases we think are, where we can make a difference.
So you explained to me before we started this conversation on record, you explained to me that you can, in the Netherlands, you can be an attorney and work in an NGO. How did you feel still about leaving private practice to go for work in an NGO, like in a different environment?
I would feel really, really sorry if I would really lose my toga, my robes, and not be able to plea anymore. I love pleading in court, and I love that part. And that's also, I've done hundreds of cases in court, and I would really suffer if I would lose that experience. I do, what I left behind is the individual context and really helping people in individual situations. But I've gained, well, what I already explained. And we have a system in the Netherlands where you have these in-house lawyers that can go to court for their own bosses, for their own employers. And sometimes when they work for a union, for instance, for a trade union, they can also help their clients, so the trade unionists. And what we asked the Bar Association, if it was possible for me to become a lawyer for the human rights organization and help NGOs that also fight for human rights.
So this was new too, actually.
There have been two others that are in similar conditions. There's a fantastic lawyer at Greenpeace International that's also a lawyer. Mm-hmm. He did it. And I was also allowed. So I can just, I am officially with the bar, I'm a completely a lawyer. We are also a law firm, so if I...
So you're both an NGO and a law firm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And it's in the United States and in South Africa, a lot of the organizations that I see as inspiration and as role models, they have the same. They're all lawyers and they're an NGO.
Mm. I really don't think this exists in France. But so I understand.
I've never met anyone in France.
So I guess that this is part of why you enjoy what you do so much, right? Because you can keep working for the causes that you really care about while practicing as you like to practice.
Yeah, and we can also, I think the difference between normal litigation and strategic litigation is that normal litigation, as a normal lawyer, you fight for the case, and sometimes that can become very strategic and in the public interest, but we fight for the cause. So we find the best case to serve the cause. So if there's an individual that has a brilliant case, but his or her outcome can harm the cause that you are fighting for, we will always reject it. We will only do the cases that we think benefit the broader movement or the NGO.
Yeah, you go micro.
Yeah, and that's that. I think that's very interesting, and makes it very different.
So it makes it very interesting and different, but it must be hard too, no? Like, you have cases that you say, well, no, we can't take it because... But then you've done that, so I guess, and you know attorneys who can take care of these people in particular, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the other way around, there was always a lot of frustration where you saw this law and you were thinking, if someone would just use this argument with a client that looks like this and has these NGOs and these lawyers combined, they could actually maybe win. And now we have the possibility to build cases like that. So it's all, I mean, of course, we can do a lot of cases we cannot do, but there are also a lot of cases that we can do and really bring our law work to practice. And that's also very, very interesting. And I mean, the fact that we don't have to, I mean, it's not that it's easy for us. It's very difficult getting funding. I get paid a lot less than when I was working for for a commercial firm, even though it was legal aid. I mean, this is just an NGO, so it's and I'm not complaining because I have the
of course
best lawyer's job, I think, for my from my perspective that I could think of in the Netherlands. But it's also, I mean, it's difficult, but at the same time, the liberty that we have to build these cases and really think, I mean, we have the focus from our NGO, so, I mean, it also has to be something that our NGO is worried about. But if we see new developments in refugees being kicked out or the rule of law being attacked or the freedom to protest is being taken away by mayors, we can just decide, okay, this is what we're going to fight, and that's... I don't necessarily have to have that experience. I can just find the lawyers in academia that do. I have the experience of building a strategic case. Mm-hmm. And that's also fun.
I have a little curiosity that is completely besides this, but I can see that you have a piercing in your ear. I understand that you've had a piercing here. So on your eyebrow, was it, your piercing on your eyebrow, did you take it away a long time ago?
Yeah. A long time ago.
So before you became a lawyer?
No, I think I still had it when I was a lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was about to ask you how it was, and you have long hair, like we can see a hint of your young activist look in there.
Yeah.
Is it something that that has been brought up to you and while you were a professional?
Well, I think it really helps. I'm a white man, and that makes it, unfortunately, for a lot of reasons, easier. If you have a lot of clients, people will trust you if you're a white man, which is stupid, but that is, you can do a lot more crazy stuff if you're a white man doing this as a job than if you're female or black or whatever. So I can get away with more. And at the same time, I always wear a suit.
Yeah, of course.
And because, I don't think it's of course. Because
really?
I think it would, I also know a lot of people that would not do that because they would think, I'm their ally, I'm their comrade, I'm in the same circle, I can just wear whatever I want. But I think it's very important to show to them that we're professionals, that they hire us or work with us because we're lawyers, and that we fit the profile of how a lawyer should look like.
Mm-hmm. So that was clear for you from the beginning, that you had to enter in a role.
Yeah, yeah. And also how I discuss with other professional parties and wear a lot of different masks and also in how I write my emails or letters. So then at least the hair and the earring, I think, well, that can be just a little bit my own autograph, or would you make it a little bit stay in myself, or
your little singularity thing.
My little singularity thing, yeah.
And how do you feel about wearing all those masks? Is it something that you enjoy?
Yeah, I enjoy it. Yeah, that's really my thing. Yeah, so I really like, sometimes it's difficult when these groups are combined, but I feel very comfortable with hardcore activists or with Roma Sinti travelers or with poor Somali community organizers or with academia or with sometimes commercial lawyers. I can also convene with, and if you have these groups combined, then it's very difficult because you use a different language and also different how you sit and if you wear swear words or not. And so sometimes that's interesting, but I like to work with that.
Great. So I have three little questions before we finish. One is, if you can talk to us about a current source of inspiration for you.
I think I am very inspired by the people that go into the climate protesters, and especially the school students, I think are very inspiring. I think that's very inspiring. And I think, and there are a few strategic litigation organizations that I think are awesome and really combine the strategic and the legal and the politics, like the Center for Constitutional Rights in the United States. I think they're fantastic. And a lot of South African organizations try to follow what they do. So from a legal perspective, that really inspires me.
What is your last joy?
My?
Last joy.
The last thing I really enjoyed?
Yeah, your last joy, source of joy.
It's difficult because of the elections and stuff. It's all. I've read a fantastic book that I really, really liked.
What was it?
It's called The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. And
okay.
It's very political, science fiction, feminist, post-apocalyptic work. It's amazing. Everyone should read it.
Okay, well, that's why I ask. And last question, I don't know how to phrase it in English and in the Netherlands, but you know, in France, the lawyers, they wear a dress. We mm-hmm. call it a dress.
Yeah, we call it a toga. Toga.
So, what do you wear under your toga?
My suit.
Your suit.
Yeah, I always wear my suit because you never know when you have to take it off and you have this meeting, and then if you wear your, strange t-shirt or whatever. So I always have my suit on.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much, Yael, for this interview.
Yes. Thank you.